Okay, it is October 21st, 2010, I believe, right? We were at the offices of WilmerHale interviewing Mr. Ken Lewis, former CEO of Bank of America. Mr. Lewis, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today. My name is Chris Seifer. This is Claire Moraine. We're both with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis by the end of this year. It tells us to look at many areas, including institutions that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance, an area that Merrill and Countrywide sort of fall into, but not quite, and also tells us to look at the role of non-traditional mortgage lending, securitization, and many other things. So we certainly thought it made sense to talk to you. Being the former CEO of Bank of America, we figured you could probably give us some pretty good unique insights on various causes. As we talked about a little before we threw on the tape, or I should say the recorder, dating myself, before we get into the substance, could you please briefly summarize your educational and work background, starting with college? And I'm sorry, Reg, you're right. Before you do that, you wanted to say something for the record.
Yeah, I just wanted to, for the record, to reflect that this is Reg Brown from WilmerHale, joined by Mike Hazel and Sarah Fuel from our firm, as well as Mr. Lewis's personal counsel. We've given you a letter, which you've seen before, requesting confidential treatment and objecting to the use of the tape for third parties, including book publishers and the like. Thanks.
Sure. So that, Mr. Lewis, please.
Well, I wanted to say that I had I'd hoped that the next time I came to Washington was to bring my grandchildren, but maybe next time.
Well, you still could have.
Well, I could. I graduated from Georgia State University in Atlanta, Georgia, with a BBA in finance in September of 1969. And give me license with this, but I think 1982 I also went to the Stanford Executive Program. I joined the bank and joined NCNB, which stood for North Carolina National Bank, in September of 1969. I held various positions. I initially was a credit analyst, then was in our corporate banking group for some time. I went to New York in 1977 to run our international banking company. I came back and ran our corporate banking and middle market group. 85 went to Florida to run our Florida bank. In 1988, when First Republic failed, I went there to run First, what was then NCNB Texas, which was the conversion of First Republic. Came back to Charlotte in 90 and 92. I went to Atlanta, Georgia, when we bought CNS Sovereign. Then subsequently was named president of the corporation. Went back to Charlotte. And then was involved in several acquisitions that we made after that time, including Boatman's and Barnett. And then I went for a brief time to San Francisco when Nations Bank bought Bank of America. But to regress a minute, in 92, when NCNB bought CNS Sovereign, we changed the name to Nations Bank. Then in 1991, I became CEO. And
2001.
What did I say? 99. Oh, excuse me. Yeah, 2001. And subsequent to that, we had several acquisitions, including Fleet, including MB&A, U.S. Trust, LaSalle in Chicago. Countrywide, and then Merrill Lynch. I retired at December 31st, 2009. So roughly 9 years as CEO.
Okay. And did you work after the retirement in December 31st, 2009?
I have not. No.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I have worked since I was 10 years old, so I thought I'd take off for a while.
You obviously deserved it after that much work. Okay, so let's jump right into the high-level discussion first. As I told you in the beginning, our job is to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis. So let's first start there. What are your opinions on the primary causes of the financial crisis?
Well, everything is so intertwined, I'm not sure I can give you even in a two-hour session, all the reasons and all the interdependencies. But I think there were a number of things. I could start with a very low interest rate environment for an extended period of time, which caused there to be a quest for yield and willingness to take risk that perhaps had not been there in the past. I think assumptions about the housing market obviously were too rosy, and the drastic or more draconian scenarios just were not in most people's formulas in terms of how bad things could get. There was a notion that real estate was local, not national, and while there was a lot of empirical evidence of that in the past, that turned out not to be true. I think in some cases there were dependencies on rating agencies' assessment of risk that proved to be inadequate. I also think that a reserve accounting, that is the pro-cyclical nature of that, was a contributor. And I also think that that mark-to-market accounting had something to do with all of this. I've never known why people would think that you want transparency of an instrument that had no market, that you were kidding yourself to think that transparency gave you the right answer. And then in a broader sense, some risk models just didn't. Risks were too optimistic in several areas, including home equity and credit card, which hurt obviously the banks more than the pure investment banks. Those are things that come off the top of my head, but there are probably a thousand other things that I just haven't thought of this morning.
So let me follow up on some of those if I can, and see if I can get some additional color from you. The first thing you mentioned was a low interest rate environment for an extended period of time that led to a quest for yield. Do you have any more color on that? And in particular, while you were CEO at B of A starting in 2001, how did you see that manifesting itself? And what were the various ways you saw that manifesting itself?
Well, I think part of the subprime issues were people chasing market share and better yield because you could get a better yield on a riskier product. I think you also saw it in investors willing to invest in more complex products that had been done in the past because of their quest for yield. Those would be two manifestations of that.
I have to confess, I have not done a deep dive on B of A's financials over the decade of the 2000s, but can you explain to me if so, how much B of A got into subprime lending, either as a mortgage banker or as originating for on balance sheet?
Yeah, we had a company called Equicredit, and it did subprime lending. And in the third quarter of 2001, we made the decision to get out of that business. And it was more about the business model than any other one thing. And by that I mean the business model for Equicredit was to use brokers to generate loans. And I've never liked a broker-based business. I always want, if we're going to do something, that it be our employees, not someone else. And so as a result of that, we were not in the origination of subprime mortgages.
Why did you not like using brokers as opposed to your own employees?
Because I felt like I felt like we would have more control over the value system of the individuals if they were employees of ours, and probably just more oversight than we could have if they were brokers.
Did Bank of America use brokers for prime loans?
No.
So it didn't use them at all?
No, we had our own originators of.
Okay. Were there, other than the fact that the business model for, and I'm sorry, what was the name of the company?
It's called EquiCredit.
EquiCredit. What was using loan brokers as opposed to in-house folk? Were there other reasons why B of A got out of the subprime game? Was it a concern with the product itself as opposed to the business model of originating it?
It was just the fear of the unknown of what that broker might be saying to someone that would not be consistent with our policies if we were doing it direct, things of that nature. Just getting out of bounds with what we would think would be proper behavior.
And I understand that. I mean, another thing we see with subprime loans is that they are less creditworthy borrowers. And to sort of take it beyond subprime to the more broader description of non-traditional mortgage loans, one of the things we've seen in looking at things over the decade of the 2000s is increased loan-to-value ratios, lower FICO scores, higher debt-to-income ratios, pick your risk layer, right? I mean, there was more and more risk being layered onto these loans. How did B of A, or did B of A, make these at least relatively riskier types of loans during the decade of the 2000s?
Well, the only place we would have been doing that related to mortgages would be in our CRA portfolio, Community Reinvestment Act mm-hmm. portfolio. But there was a lot of pretty good work around how we did those in terms of education sessions with the borrowers and a lot of verification in their willingness to have the right budgets and have the ability to repay those loans. And so I don't put those in the same category as just a one-off subprime loan. But if you looked at probably the FICO scores and some of the loan-to-value scores, you could put them in that category in that case.
Mm-hmm. Were in relative terms, what was the performance of the CRA loans compared to the non-CRA loans?
They did worse, but not dramatically worse, until the depths of the recession. And then, of course, that group is going to be affected first, and they did more poorly than our prime loans.
Mm-hmm. So, other than the CRA portfolio, why did the bank not get into the non-traditional type mortgage loan business?
Well, we had a growing customer base and a philosophy of trying to do more with that customer base, and so there wasn't a dearth of opportunity. I mean, we had broad opportunities to grow our portfolio, and until the bad times came, the economy was growing, and there was no need to delve more deeply into the FICO scores.
Did the bank originate pay option ARM loans?
No.
Did the bank originate 100% loan-to-value ratio loans, whether it's one loan or these 80-20 piggyback loans that we've seen?
Not to my knowledge. I'm a little hesitant because some of the CRA loans get close to that, but I don't think we ever did 100%, but we get fairly low down payments.
Mm-hmm. What about loans with negative amortization features?
No.
What about interest-only mortgage loans?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Okay. The second thing you mentioned were assumptions about the housing market that were too rosy and models that perhaps didn't consider a downturn or perhaps enough of a downturn. Could you maybe just provide a little more color on that and what you meant by assumptions about the housing market being too rosy? And I also recall you said, there was a feeling that real estate was local, not national. What you meant by that?
Well, first, if you go back and look at what was happening, the number of new housing starts was exceeding by some measure the growth in the population. And you can explain some of that by some of the subprime lending that was going on, so more people were getting loans than before. And you can explain some of that by the fact that more people were buying second homes. But all of that was tied to an assumption about housing prices continuing to rise and the ability to access equity through the home equity loans, therefore allowing you to buy the second homes. At some point, that's going to catch up with you. That is the fact that the population growth is not going as fast as new housing starts, and it did. And then the second piece is it did not make sense at the time to think that housing in Los Angeles, California would be going down and necessarily it would be going down in Atlanta, Georgia at the same time. As it turned out, that was a false premise, that in fact the housing debacle became a national issue, not local. To my knowledge, that has not happened before, certainly not in my lifetime. We can think of New England, we can think of Texas, but in those cases, other areas were doing just fine and continue to do just fine.
At Bank of America, did the models that you folks used, to whether it's a Monte Carlo simulation analysis or whatever type of stress testing model you folks use, did it assume? Did it run scenarios where there was an assumption of house price declines everywhere in the U.S.?
I didn't see all the models, but not to my knowledge. We felt, and I would say personally, I felt that the statement that housing is local and not national, I felt that pretty strongly because of my experience in 40 years.
What about, I'll tell you, one of the things I've heard from a lot of people that we've talked to is, we ran simulation analyses assuming declines in house prices, but we didn't run them, assuming the level of decline that we ended up seeing in 2008. If, to the extent you recall, what kinds of house price declines, how large of a decline were you guys running in your models?
At some point, we thought there would be a 30% decline. But that was after we had been shocked at some of the declines already. I can't remember what the total would have been, but even after some significant declines, we still had a 30% decline in our models, and that was most likely not draconian. But the issue really was we had been surprised even before then that houses had declined in terms of the amounts they did, and in fact across the board in many cases.
So, can you place timing at all in terms of when you started stressing at 30% house price declines, 2007, 8?
It was 8, I think. I think it was 8. I think I can remember that that's when we were saying that we expected another 30% decline.
Did the bank ever, in addition to increasing the level of house price decline, that's articulate, isn't it, increasing the level of decline, did the bank ever also use in its models a decline in house prices across the nation as opposed to just certain geographic locations?
To the best of my recollection, it was still local. It was local slash national in the sense we didn't just say 30% across the country. It ended up that being the average, but we said, okay, in Nevada there'd be decreasing more, in certain places in Los Angeles they'd be decreasing more because they were. And so it's the model still looked at the various geographies, and of course the ones that were most draconian were California, Florida, Nevada, Arizona, and probably Michigan.
When did, and I know I'm taxing your memory here, but of course we've seen from looking at the data that the level of home price appreciation starts to flatten out, I want to say 06, maybe it's even earlier, and then actually starts its decline, I believe, in late 06, certainly by 07. To the extent you recall, when did B of A, you know, start believing that there may be, you know, additional stresses or downturns coming in the housing market, and how did it respond?
I don't recall when, but I do recall that we, you know, we had that feeling at some, you know, at some point. I just can't remember the years. Well, we started tightening up on our FICO scores, tightening up on loan to values and down payments.
Do you recall if it was before the actual decline in home prices, or even before the decline in the rate of growth in home price
appreciation? No, I don't think so. I think we got to some extent got caught off. You know, we're a little late in doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A third area you mentioned when you were listing the things that you thought were primary causes was dependence on rating agencies. Could you give us a little more color on that, please?
Yeah, in a broad sense, I think some entities almost subcontracted the risk management to the rating agencies and had an over-reliance on their assessment as opposed to their own risk management assessment.
What kind of entities, if you know, did you see doing that, subcontracting their risk management to simply relying on a AAA rating?
Right. Yeah, I don't know any specifics, but you see in a broad sense that they weren't AAA and you know, eventually didn't turn out to be AAA, and a lot of us had them.
Maybe anticipating my next question. Again, like I said, I haven't done the deep dive on B of A, but I suspect there was a securities and an investment portfolio on the balance sheet. How did B of A go about doing its due diligence on the securities that it held on book?
Well, we have a risk management group that looked at them, and then you need to get your rating agency, you know, the grade, so you can actually sell to investors. And I don't. It would be a speculation as to whether psychologically we had some people even in our own risk management group that put too much reliance on it. But we did have basically two looks at it: our risk management group and the rating agencies. And Bank of America never had yearly massive losses like a Citigroup or UBS. We had our first quarterly loss in 17 years in the fourth quarter of 2008.
I believe it's the case. I should tell you, before I was a lawyer, I was a bank examiner. But I believe it was the case that, you know, the higher rating, the lower risk-based capital requirement on the asset. Did that impact at all B of A's, you know, strategy on holding assets on balance sheet?
Well, it did not affect the way our risk management group looked at the security. It would affect the way we would look at whether we held it or sold it because of lower capital. That is not to say our risk management group would cut any corners or want to have a rosier look at it just because it was lower capital. That's not their job.
Mm-hmm. What about same area of investments on book, as I'm sure you know, since you acquired Merrill Lynch? I mean, one of the things we saw with that company is that they ended up retaining a lot of super senior tranches of CDOs that they underwrote and issued, or tried to issue, but didn't, that resulted in billions of dollars of losses, or at least write-downs for that company, and losses. Did B of A have much of the structured product on book?
We had some, but we were not in the same league as some of the ones that had the massive losses. And I'd say the big leagues, in the negative sense, would have been UBS, Citigroup, and Merrill Lynch.
Right. Well, they're certainly the ones that took the losses. Again, I mean, was there a difference in the risk management approach of evaluating those types of investments at B of A than other type of investments?
I don't think so. We had capital markets people looking at them, and they would be the same ones that had been looking at other type instruments.
Do you know if the folks at B of A were actually looking at the models that the rating agencies were using to rate these securities?
I do not know.
Okay. Do you have any opinions about the rating agencies' actual ratings of the securities, whether structured product or otherwise?
Well, just at the time, they had to have had some assumptions that were erroneous because the AAA securities turned out to be not as AAA as they were saying they were,
right,
or high grade or whatever.
You mentioned pro-cyclical reserve accounting. I think I know what you mean by that, but can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I've said in the past that it seems so simple to me that the squirrels know better. The fact that you're building reserves during bad times and releasing them during good times seems to be the opposite of what you should be a financial institution should be doing. And it creates major systemic risk at exactly the wrong time. And I think every head of every regulatory agency agrees with that.
And I just want to make sure I heard that correctly. Building reserves during good times and reducing them in bad times is exactly the opposite of what should be done.
I'm sorry, I said it backwards. I said it backwards.
All right,
I
heard
you
said
it backwards. You heard it backwards.
No.
Good, because...
Either way. Right.
That's the squirrel analogy.
And why do you think that's the case? Why are banks and other institutions reducing their reserves during good times and not building them up?
I think that's a clash with the SEC and regulatory agencies.
Okay. And, of course, you may recall that back in 1998, Mr. Leavitt made the cookie jar reserve speech.
I don't remember that.
Well, it was basically, I'm concerned about banks and other institutions managing earnings by setting aside too many reserves, so when the next quarter comes and they're not going to meet the street, they pull the cookie out of the jar to meet the street, my take on it anyway. But was that an issue at Bank of America that prevented it from establishing more reserves than it wanted to, simply GAAP accounting requirements?
Yes.
Okay. Couldn't a bank, now I'm asking and I don't know the answer to this question, is there a way to increase your reserves or do the effect of same of increasing reserves without incurring the GAAP expense?
Not to my knowledge.
Did you or did folks at B of A ever have any discussions with either the bank regulators or the SEC about this issue?
I have talked about it both publicly and with the OCC, the Federal Reserve, and the FDIC. And I had those discussions through the Federal Reserve Advisory Council, which I was a member of.
And when were those discussions taking place?
The last ones would have been 2009.
And when were the first ones? I guess I'd be more interested in.
I don't know when I first got on that high horse or that bandwagon, but I felt that way for a long time. But obviously, it was more top of mind when you were actually having to build the reserves during that 2009 time.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if the SEC or even the bank regulators ever came? I mean, being a bank examiner, I can hardly remember ever going into an institution and saying, you have too many loan loss reserves. Right. I mean, we're just risk averse that way. But did the SEC, I mean, and again, into the time when you're CEO, 2001 forward, do you recall whether or not the SEC or even the bank regulators, you know, expressed any of those types of concerns that they were over-reserving?
I do recall John Dugan of the OCC actually being asked the question, did he agree with me on my statement? And he said yes. And there's a commission, or I may not be calling it the right thing, but there's some group that I guess would have the responsibility of addressing that would include membership of the SEC and the regulators. I'm just not sure what it's called.
And do you recall ballpark timing of when you recall Mr. Dugan?
I think it was sometime in mid-2009. That's about as close as I can get.
Do you recall?
I think he went on to say, I do agree, but it's not going to be done this time.
And I'm more interested, as you can probably imagine, in sort of pre-crisis time frame about whether or not you recall any discussions with the regulators or the SEC about, you know, look, we are in a stage of banks, particularly Bank of America, since that's the one you're running, you know, reporting profits, and it's an opportunity to build our reserves for that rainy day that eventually comes. Do you recall any discussions about that and the constraint, you know, whether it's the SEC or generally accepted accounting principles preventing you guys from doing that?
No, I don't recall.
Did you see that as a problem back then?
I've seen it for some time. I just can't. I don't know when I really. It really was so clear to me, other than, you know, this recent crisis. Mm-hmm. Just conceptually, it's just never made sense to me.
The detention.
Okay, and then another thing you mentioned was mark-to-market accounting. Can you provide us a little more color on how you saw mark-to-market accounting as being a cost?
There were others more affected by this than we, but we were affected to some degree. I think there are times that when markets dry up completely, that it is fictitious to think you're marking an asset to market when there is no market. And there ought to be some mechanism to stop that process until you can get some proof of a market actually operating.
So, I understand that, but mark-to-market accounting, as I understand it anyway, isn't marked to a fire sale price, it's mark-to-market. So if you do have, for example, in the fall of 07 and into 08, a freezing up of certain markets, particularly for the non-transparent, illiquid, structured product and other types of things, that you can't just go to the internet and see what the stock price is or see what the bond price is, but you have to build in assumptions for a model and come up with a value. Help me understand better why mark-to-market accounting is a problem in that.
Well, I think in some cases that becomes impossible because the markets have dried up so severely that it's not a reflection of a market that really exists. And so there ought to be sometimes when you suspend that process until, I don't know how you would define it, but until X amount of transactions take place or something that can be proven on a more realistic basis than things are at that time.
How did Bank of America value its assets, at least its trading assets and other assets that had to be carried on the books at market value?
Yeah, I don't know the procedures, but our people didn't think they reflected any long-term fair or any fair value.
Okay. You may recall, in the beginning of 2007, actually earlier than that, the Financial Accounting Standards Board passed a pronouncement called Statement of Financial Accounting 157. I think there was 159 also. Essentially, what this required was for financial institutions to report assets as level 1, level 2, and level 3. There were many early adopters. It wasn't required to be adopted until 08. But frankly, in the spring of 07, a lot of folks were reporting those types of disclosures. And of course, DI banks seemed to be the first, since they had November year ends as opposed to December year ends. So in the March time frame, or even earlier, you saw that coming out in public disclosures in the K for 2007. And several folks that we've talked to, market participant type folks, have said that was an eye-opener for them, because suddenly they saw a lot of these level 2 and particularly level 3 assets that, you know, where the valuation was clearly much more subjective. Like we said, it wasn't just going to the internet and getting a bond price or a stock price, but they were clearly marked to model assets. My question after that long lead-in is, do you recall if there were any issues at B of A about when it started disclosing level 1, 2, and 3 assets and any challenges that provided?
I don't.
Do you recall whether any folks in the investor relations department or elsewhere whether there was any kind of impact from an investor standpoint on the transparency of B of A's financial, the additional transparency of B of A's financial statements?
I do not.
Okay. Was there a time period when you saw problems with mark-to-market accounting being more pronounced than other time periods?
The level of feedback on that, or issues that you heard from the finance group and CFO, would have been, I guess it would have started in around the third quarter of 2007. Just the issue being raised more often, and then got more acute as time went on in 2008 and 2009. The reserve building issue was a little later. Was probably that became an issue in 2008 and 2009.
And actually, let me follow up on that. How did the reserve issue become more of an issue in 08 and 09?
Well, you were at a time that you had the most stress on your portfolio. You were building reserves and actually more than what you were charging off. And so it's almost like you're building for good times and the bad times. And common sense would say you would use your reserves during the bad times.
Mm-hmm. But isn't it, maybe I'm demonstrating my ignorance, even though I do have a bank examiner background, but aren't you pretty much, it's pretty much normally the case that your provision is going to be higher than your charge-offs, because your provision is an estimate of probable and estimable losses in the future.
Well, first of all, I'm talking to an ex-bank examiner, so you're going to be biased in this. But I think it's logical to build the reserves in good times and to actually use some of the reserves in bad times. So your provision is not higher in bad times. It's actually less than your charge-offs.
Okay. I admit that I am biased towards having more reserves on any institution.
Well, I am too. I am too. I just think we've got it backwards in how you build.
And I agree with you there too. Okay. And then another thing you had mentioned about risk models is that you mentioned that you thought they were too optimistic in terms of HELOCs and credit card loans. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, in Bank of America's case, we did not. Our projections for the GDP were more consistent with the Fed, and we missed the degree of declines in the economy, and so we, because of that rosier forecast, we had assumptions about the portfolio which were rosier than it turned out to be, and so we actually in our credit card portfolio and home equity portfolio had higher losses than we had ever experienced as a result of the as the recession loomed, and that is a major disappointment for me that we that our consumer loan portfolio in those two areas performed as poorly as not. Now we had a prime residential portfolio, so that wasn't the major issue with us. It was those other two categories. In our corporate loans and our commercial loans performed relatively well, and so the issues were very not isolated but focused on those two product categories.
Did the bank use different models for projecting losses on those different types of loans, though? I mean, HELOCs and credit cards tend to default quicker than an owner-occupied first deed of trust home loan.
No, but the performance of the X-FICO score was worse than what we had expected because the economy deteriorated so much. And so it wasn't that the model was different. We just didn't. Our economic assumptions were too rosy. Mm-hmm. And again, consistent with the Fed, so it wasn't that we were Pollyannish.
Let me ask you about a couple of areas that you didn't mention, simply because they're in our statute, and I'd like to get your opinions on them. And the very first thing our statute tells us to look at is the role of fraud in the financial crisis. Do you have any opinions on that?
Well, I think there was significant fraud, particularly around the subprime lending area. I wouldn't say that there was major fraud in most commercial banks' portfolios.
And what kind of fraud did bank, I mean, you didn't have a big subprime portfolio, if any, but what kind of fraud were you seeing in your mortgage portfolio anyway?
We weren't seeing a lot of that. These are this is just a reference to what we've read about and heard about with regard to people not telling the truth about their incomes, for instance, or debt.
What about on the other side of it? Again, maybe my bank examiner bias is coming out again. And or maybe this is one of the reasons you didn't like using mortgage brokers. But sometimes we have seen, both in my job here in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission and as a bank examiner, fraud from the inside, simply because of either compensation structures or quotas to get loan volume up, where it is the loan officer or the loan broker or whoever it may be, fudging the DTI ratios or the income, or of course the problem that we saw all the time in the S&L crisis, the appraiser, just overvaluing the property. Did you see much of that in the 2000s?
No, not really. I mean, with 287,000 employees, somebody's messing up as we speak, but not anything widespread.
Another area that we're looking at that I'm sure you have a fair amount of experience with is regulation and the role of the regulators in the financial crisis. Do you see that as any part of it? Obviously, being at B of A, you certainly dealt with the Fed, you dealt with the OCC. I suspect you probably had some type of S&L subsidiary that was being regulated by the OTS, but I don't know that. But what are your opinions on the role of regulation or the lack thereof contributing to the financial crisis?
Well, with regard to the subsidiary, we had a policy of if we had an OTS from an acquisition or something, we would always fold it in, and so we were a national bank and enacted that way. I think there are times, and this is not just this time, in general, I would say as a rule of thumb, when things get really tough, there's a separation of the rhetoric of the policymakers and the examiners, that despite the fact sometimes that we're not going to be too horrid in one area or not, you know, rhetoric by the policymakers, the examiners seem to have a mind of their own, and they get really tough during the tough times. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that that's what I've observed, that phenomenon, more than one time.
What kind of value added did you see from the regulators while you were CEO of B of A, if any?
I think some of the things that they required us to do around liquidity and stress testing were actually turned out to be very good for the bank. We were always very liquid because we had such a core, you know, deposit base, but still, I think having, you know, draconian stress tests on liquidity and particularly liquidity were very important, because at the end of the day, it's usually lack of liquidity that brings you down.
Do you know, was the SEC a prudential regulator of the investment bank at B of A at all?
No, we were. No, the focus on us was the Fed and the SEC. I mean, we have contact with the SEC, but right, the real day-to-day conversations were with those two entities.
We touched upon this a little, but let me ask you. Another area the statute tells us to look at is the originate-to-distribute model securitization in general, and just tell you, one of the things we have seen in the decade of the 2000s was an increase in that. It seemed like, at least in relative terms, before the turn of the century, you know, there was a lot of origination was being originated to be held on the book. And then you had a fairly explosion in securitization, and in particular by the street, by private securitizations as opposed to just Fannie and Freddie. And you have the growth of the shadow banking system with folks originating loans that were not regulated and that were just originating them for sale, and then of course the securitizers would just put them together and send them off, and the thinking and the criticism has always been that along the chain people are taking fees but don't have any skin in the game. Any opinions on whether the growth in securitization or the originate-to-distribute model is a contributing cause to the crisis?
I can't quantify it, but I would answer your question yes. And I think it is a good thing to require originators to have skin in the game and keep some portion on their books.
What about compensation structures? Do you think that, again, the statute tells us to look at that to see if compensation structures at institutions motivated excessive risk-taking, for example. Did you see that at all?
It's hard to ever just pinpoint and say that was the reason that this deal was done. I don't think that was the case. That kind of behavior at the very top of these companies, I don't think that. But certainly it is possible that at certain levels where there was great reward to be had for doing these things, that's possible. I can't give you an instance.
How did B of A structure its comp system to guard against folks taking excessive risks?
Well, we did have cliff portion of the compensation being in stock and it being cliff vested over three years. But I wouldn't say that's the first line of defense is that you have a good risk management system that puts fences around the ability of these individuals to trade and to take risk. And that would always be my thought as the first line of defense.
another area that we've looked at least the term is too big to fail, although I think it could be too interconnected to fail as opposed to too big to fail. But I suspect you might have opinions on this given how big Bank of America was and is, particularly through the acquisitions. Do you see that as a contributing cause?
Well, I agree with your statement that it's more too interconnected to fail, and that size may have, in some cases, very little to do with it. But, I think back to Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, Countrywide, Wachovia, WaMu. They were all bought by big banks. And I don't know what the consequences would have been had those big banks not been there to do that, but probably pretty dire. And so I think that's a good example of big is not always bad. I've always thought also that there is beauty in diversity of people, product, geography, and that scale does matter. So, and the disproof of that, probably the only time I can think of was this crisis, because everything seemed to be hit. Nobody seemed to be unaffected. No products unaffected, and no businesses unaffected. But more often than not, that diversity gives you much better chance to survive and to prosper in the future.
Mm-hmm. And there's certainly no question, at least in my mind, that as the crisis certainly came into being in 08, and for you folks in 07, that banks like particularly B of A and J.P. Morgan were certainly able to help by taking over Countrywide, taking over Merrill, and in J.P. Morgan's case, taking over Bear and taking over WaMu. But that said, for example, do you think B of A is too big to fail? If it, God forbid, got in trouble?
No, I don't think anybody's too big to fail. If you don't follow the right procedures and don't learn from history, but I think that our capital base, our diversity, our scale makes the odd much less than somebody who's smaller.
And I understand that, and let me tell you a couple things we've seen. And how the regulators were evaluating institutions like Wachovia and others if they did come in and prevent from failing, or at least voted to come in, even though they ended up not having to in Wachovia's case because Wells eventually came in. But essentially what the Federal Reserve and the OCC and the FDIC were doing, from what I see anyway in the document, is saying, okay, here's this institution that's not going to make it. In the normal course, we would look at the uninsured deposit to see the cost of the insurance fund and let them go down. But there is a systemic risk exception in FDICIA, and and essentially what they did was they looked at the liability structure of Wachovia, for example, and said, well, here are the various counterparties that are holding their commercial paper and other type medium-term notes, et cetera, and if Wachovia goes down, they're going to lose money. And that's going to impact them. That's going to have an impact on not only those institutions, but the economy in general, not just the national economy, but the international economy. In a sense, they're doing the systemic analysis of what's going to be the domino impact on certain institutions and what's going to be the impact on the economy and markets in general. And they at least made the determination in Wachovia's case. We're not going to let them fail because the bigger evil is what's going to happen to those other institutions and the economy and markets in general. And that's what I meant. I mean, I understand that B of A is diversified and has a capital base, but God forbid they get in trouble and they are not going to survive. I suspect that there are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, and of counterparties, that would be adversely affected by that. And from what we've seen, or I should say from what I've seen, it would seem to me that institutions like Bank of America and J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, an argument can be made that they're simply too big and interconnected to let fail if, God forbid, they get in trouble. So that's more what I wanted your opinion on.
That's why I said interconnected as opposed to size, because some huge piece of a Bank of America is pretty vanilla. I mean, 55 million consumer customers, a huge base of commercial customers that are not so intertwined with Wall Street or with, you know, securities, et cetera. I think always you will have situations where the interconnectivity is so great that it's going to be very difficult to say, okay, just let them go. Mm-hmm. And will that be KKR next, since they're buying, you know, Goldman Sachs proprietary trading desk?
Right.
Does that get so big that that they're in that, and they wouldn't be that big, but they may be that interconnected?
And I read Morgan Stanley was spinning off FrontPoint. I just had to mention it. Okay, so let's move to some more specific areas and off the causes of the financial crisis, some more B of A specific stuff, and I'll try to go chronological. I think the best way to approach it first with Countrywide, can you just sort of walk us through?
Suggest that,
taking a break?
That we take a break
sure.
before we do that piece?
Sure.
Yes,
why don't
we do that?
Okay.
We'll take 5 minutes.
Is that good?